Okay.
All right. Well, I'm on page 48. I'm on page 50. And we are in chapter 10, verse 11. Now, we talked last time about the fact that Daniel 10, 11, 12 is all based around a prophecy that Daniel gets at some particular point in time when he prays. This is the third great vision that he has, all having to do with nation states. And this particular vision he has he's praying because he recognizes that according to Jeremiah, the time for the restoration of Israel should be at hand, and nothing's quite happening yet, and he's concerned about what's going to happen to Israel. So he prays and fasts and seeks the Lord about what is going to happen to the nation of Israel. And he prays and prays and prays, and nothing happens for 3 weeks, and then all of a sudden he gets an angel with an answer. And what we're going to talk about today, what all the angel says. But it says in verse 11, he, that's the angel, said to me, O Daniel, man of high esteem, understand the words that I'm about to tell you and stand upright, for I've now been sent to you. And he said, stand upright, because Daniel was on his face, as we usually would be if we had an appearance of an angel or spiritual being in our... I mean, throughout the Bible, the first thing they say to us is, fear not. And the last, you know, and the reason is because we are. When he had spoken this word to me, I stood up trembling. He said to me, do not be afraid, Daniel, fear not. For from the first day that you set your heart on understanding this and humbling yourself before your God, your words were heard, and I have come in response to your words. But the prince of Persia was withstanding me for 21 days. Then behold, Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me, for I had been left there with the kings of Persia. A messenger tells Daniel that he is highly esteemed, which is high praise. Somebody from heaven is telling him that. And he tells him to be, don't be afraid. And he tells him that from the very first day that he prayed and fasted before the Lord, that he, this angel, was given this message to go give to Daniel. But that he could not get to Daniel because the archdemon over Persia wouldn't let him in. Now, this is there's a number of places in the Bible that talks about this sort of issue. But what happens is that Satan is not omnipresent. Unlike God, Satan's not everywhere at the same time. He's a creature, a single creature, and only one place at a time. And so, if we say, well, the devil made me do this, the devil made me do that, probably not. Most of us are not significant enough that we would get that kind of attention. The devil is usually someplace like Washington, D.C., where he can do the most damage. I mean that with all seriousness. There or Moscow or back and forth between them or some Middle Eastern state at this particular point in time. But because of that, we're told the devil has a third of all the hosts of heaven working for him. And we also see that they were organized originally by God in a very organized manner that the Bible describes in terms of the Persian military units. Thrones, dominions, powers, principalities, and authorities. Yeah, these are terms that come out of the Persian military that have been interpreted. And so in Scripture we see these terms being used a lot to describe the angelic ranks. So because of the way they were originally created in ranks, because the whole group fell as a unit from God, then you have this militaristic system there. And these angels are assigned out to different jobs in the earth. If you ever read C.S. Lewis's Allegory of Screwtape Letters, he talks about the fact that you've got this young angel whose name is Screwtape, and he's got this uncle named Wormwood, who is an older, experienced angel who teaches him how to seduce men, seduce mankind. And so the older angel's teaching the younger angel how to do this, which is an interesting concept with angels having ages. But anyway, nonetheless, it's the allegory. Allegories do that sometimes. So what we have here is, here in other places, the reference to the prince over Persia. A principality is an angel whose responsibility it is to govern all of the other angels under them in a country, in a principality. And so he is saying that this angel came with a message, but a higher ranking angel prevented him from getting the message to Daniel. That's what this guy is saying. Until Michael, who is one of the archangels, came and pushed him out of the way. Do not be afraid, Daniel, for the first day that you set your heart on understanding this and humbling yourself before the word before your God, your words were heard, and I've come in response to your words. But the prince of the kingdom of Persia was withstanding me for 21 days. And behold, Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me, for I had been left there with the kings of Persia. The messenger, I think we did cover all that. In Ephesians 6:11, it says this: put on the full armor of God. We're told that we're supposed to arm ourselves spiritually, that you may be able to stand firm against the schemes of the devil. For our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against rulers, powers, world forces of darkness, against spiritual forces of wickedness in heavenly places. So we're told that when we get into it with each other, we're really not into it with each other. We're actually being played in the background by these spiritual forces, and that's who our battle is with. One of the things that we realize, if we are aware, is that, like, if Nancy and I get into it about something or another, if we're spiritually aware, we realize that we're really not into it with each other. We're into it because the enemy has stirred up issues between us. And I always teach, when I teach Bible, when I teach the marriage covenants before we marry somebody, that all marital relationships are Trinitarian. That there is in every marriage relationship two people and a third person. And when that third person is God, then your marriage will flow. When that third person is not God, then your marriage will break down. Now, the other third person could be the devil in some form or another, or a devil, some spiritual, or it could be a mother-in-law, or it could be somebody's buddies, or some gal's friends. One of the things that we're told to do in order to be properly married is to leave home. And we're also told to forsake all others. But what happens is some people sort of forget that, and they want to keep certain relationships that they've had, and they let those relationships come in the way of the marital relationship. Or there's a mother-in-law, like I said, or a father-in-law, or some other inappropriate connection there in a marriage that you have to deal with sometimes to get it out. So if Nancy and I are scrapping, and we begin to realize that we're being pushed, we're being plagued by the enemy, we will stop and together pray against the enemy, unseat the third person that is the enemy, and reseat God in that place. Once we do that, then we're flowing in Trinitarian community again, and everything will smooth itself out. Because Paul tells the Ephesians, you don't wrestle against flesh and blood. What you wrestle against is spiritual wickedness in heavenly places. You know, we have this sort of comical picture in the television about the one angel sitting on your one shoulder and the bad angel sitting on your other shoulder. And that is very, very close to reality, because we know, for instance, that the Bible says we all have a guardian angel, which means we do have an angel assigned by God with us who encourages us and tries to run some interference for us. But we also know that the enemy sends spiritual beings to try to seduce us or cause us to have problems. So what we see here is that this particular prince over Persia, which is a powerful angel, an authoritative angel of high authority, was able to resist this lesser angel until Michael, the archangel, came and pushed him out of the way. He outranked him. We're told, for instance, that when Michael and Lucifer were fighting over the body of Moses, that Michael did not dare to bring a reviling judgment against Lucifer, but merely said, "The Lord rebuke you," in order to capture the body of Moses. In other words, even angels don't revile each other. At least good angels don't revile even bad angels, because that's not how it works in God's kingdom. Rush Limbaugh would be disappointed, but that's just the way it is. In 1 Corinthians 10, what do I mean then? That a thing sacrificed to idols is anything? Or that an idol is anything? No, but I say that the things which the Gentiles sacrifice, they sacrifice to demons and not to God. I do not want you to be sharers in demons. What he's saying is that these people, these Gentiles that they were dealing with who had these pagan sacrifices, they were sacrificing to these gods, these false gods. And he said, I know that you know that those false gods are really sticks of wood. But did you know that what they're really sacrificing to is demonic presences that are represented by these false gods? One of the things that we encourage people to do, sometimes people come to us and they'll say, well, we're having huge problems in our house with conflict, or we're having huge problems in our house with this fear, other issues. And then they do that because they've heard me do some teaching on this. But so they'll say, can you come and see if you can discern anything? When Nancy and I buy a house, the first thing we do is we walk through the house and we cleanse it of all of its spirits that aren't supposed to be there. There's all kinds of spirits that can be there because of what went on there before. You have unholy alliances. You have people who get to kill themselves there. You have people who practice wrong kind of practices there. And so we go into the house and we, in the name of Jesus, we cast out all the spirits there. Sometimes we discern what they are. And we plead the blood of Jesus down upon that house so for its protection. That's a biblical principle. It's not something that people do so much anymore, but it is nonetheless a biblical principle. Jesus talks about, for instance, when casting demons out of somebody, talks about sweeping out the house. So we have peace in our home because we pray peace into our home and we pray strife out. We come against it as if it's a spiritual force. We don't think of strife as just sort of a kind of a philosophical or a psychological struggle. We think of it as a spiritual issue. And so consequently, we don't have strife in our home. If some suddenly erupts in our home, then we stop and re-pray. Sometimes we try to figure out who brought it in or what brought it in or how it came in. And there's always a way that it came in. But we intentionally live in peace and rest in our home, sleep in peace and rest in our home, and we don't allow fear and other negative spiritual beings to operate there. The same thing is true with localities. There are people, for instance, who have a deep spiritual understanding of these things, and they do things like they do spiritual mapping on their cities to try to determine what is going on in their cities. When we were in seminary, Nancy and I both took a course on spiritual mapping up at Asbury, and we did a spiritual mapping of Wilmore in order to figure out what all was going on there. And the process, we discovered, among other things, that there had been a long history of sectarian battles in this particular town. And people got together from various groups, and we agreed and forgave each other and whatever, and all of that served to drive that thing out. Stuff like that. So we're told, for instance, that there was a spirit over Persia, and that this spirit was in charge of other spirits, and it was prohibiting him from coming. If you've ever been to a city, you walk into a city you've never been in before, it's not at all unusual to discern the spirit of the city. For instance, you can walk into the Vegas airport and you have this immediate sense of high decadence. You walk into Dallas and there's a spirit of divorce all over Dallas, Texas. In Alpharetta, it's the spirit of consumerism. There are demonic presences in places where you go, and they have a tendency to rule in those particular areas, and the people in those areas do that. You can have spirit of violence in some cities and whatever. And when spiritual people are functioning like they're supposed to, they gather together in a city and they do battle against these things and cause them to go away. There was a very famous case in Cleveland some years ago where a bunch of churches got together and prayed and sought the Lord and drove out some stuff that was going on there. You remember that at that particular time, the boy mayor, Dennis Kucinich, was trying to run the place, and it was just tanking. And so the people in the city who were spiritual got together and prayed and sought the Lord, and they discerned some things, and they stood against that. And there was actually a book or something written about it at the time. So Paul said, these people who worship false gods, you know that they're just bound down before a stone or a stick, but what you don't realize is that behind that stone and stick are demons. They're praying to demons without even realizing it. Isaiah said to the people who of his day, the 8th century prophets began to tell Israel that there really were no other gods besides God. Up until the 8th century, so then for about 3,000 years, the Lord was known in Israel as the Most High God, the God above all other gods. God sort of, he can only tell people so much at a time. But starting about the 8th century, the Lord began to make declaration that there were no other gods, that all the other gods were, in fact, nothing. And Isaiah has a very funny little passage in which he says, a man goes out and he cuts down a log, cuts down a tree, and with the top half of it, he builds himself a god and bows down to it. And with the bottom half, he cooks his dinner. So what he's saying is that it's really foolishness, what's going on there. However, the spiritual presence is there. So Satan's angels rule over the world and are ordered and organized. They infect and permeate and create a corporate spirit or nature where they dwell. Las Vegas, the spirit of decadence, gambling, concupiscence, Alpharetta, spirit of materialistic consumerism. Discernment of spirits is a gift of the Holy Spirit. 1 Corinthians 12:10 talks about the ability that God gives us to discern what spirits are operating in any particular place or time or circumstance. Every once in a while, you know what it's like. For instance, your daughter brings home somebody, makes your skin crawl. It's because there's something going on behind that person, or your son or something. You get around some people and you just know you don't want no part of these people because there's a spiritual presence that's operate out of them that's going on there. So he says, I have come to give you understanding. This is the angel talking to Daniel. I have come to give you understanding of what will happen to your people in the latter days. For the vision pertains to days yet future. The vision that I'm giving you is for days yet future. And when he had spoken to me according to these words, I turned my face toward the ground and became speechless. Behold, one who resembled a human being was touching my lips. And I opened my mouth and spoke and said to him who was standing before me, O my Lord. See that small L? That means that the word he's using here is just an honorific. He's not thinking this is God. As a result of the vision, anguish has come upon me, and I have retained no strength. For how can such a servant of my Lord talk with such as my Lord? As for me, there remains just now no strength in me, nor has any breath been left in me. Then this one with human appearance touched me again and strengthened me, and he said, O man of high esteem, do not be afraid. Peace be with you. Take courage and be courageous. Now, as soon as he spoke to me, I received strength and said, May my Lord speak, for you have strengthened me. So the vision is for future days, both near future and latter days. Humble Daniel continues to be overwhelmed by the presence of the angel. He's also in anguish over the vision itself, because the vision itself is terrifying. And he is touched spiritually and enabled to stand in the presence of God. Then he said, and that's the angel, he said, Do you understand why I come to you? But I shall now return to fight against the prince of Persia. So I am going forth, and behold, the prince of Greece is about to come. However, I tell you what is inscribed in the writing of the truth. Yet there is no one who stands firmly with me against these forces except Michael, your prince. Now, one of the biblical sort of principles that runs through the Bible is that there are three archangels. That Gabriel, the archangel, is sort of like the personal messenger, a representative of the Holy Spirit, and commands the... Hi, come on in, hon. We're just getting started. And commands the troop under him. That Michael is the personal messenger of the second person of the Trinity, who becomes the incarnate Christ in times to come. And that Lucifer was the personal servant of the Father. We learn in Isaiah 14 and Ezekiel 28 how Lucifer fell and what caused him to fall, why he fell, and what happened was, and the fact that he was cast out for that reason. So Michael is the angel associated with the second person of the Trinity. He's also the angel associated with Israel. He is sort of like the protector over Israel. So he said, Michael, your prince came, the prince of Israel, came and drove away the prince of Persia who he would outrank. So the vision is for near future and far future. Let's see here. Behold, the prince of Greece is about to come. However, we'll tell you what is inscribed in the writing of truth. Let's see, I think I read. Okay, yeah, because it said, No one who stands firmly with me against these forces except Michael, your prince. The angel was going to go off and fight against the prince of Persia and the coming Greek demonic principality as well. The Persian principality was trying to harm Israel. The Greek principality to come embodied in Alexander was even more hell-bent to destroy Israel. The protective principality over Israel is Michael the Archangel. It seems like a game of spiritual chess between Jesus and Satan, but we are not the pawns, we are the prize. The reason that this remember that one of the things about Satan is that he sought to gain the seat at the right hand of the Father. That seat, the right hand of the Father, was reserved for Jesus, the man, the incarnate Christ who was successful. It was reserved as a place for him as a reward. He was exalted to the seat at the right hand of the Father. Satan wanted it, couldn't have it, got jealous, and attempted to take it. Was defeated, cast out of heaven over the issue, and therefore he set about to go make war against all of Jesus' offspring, which would be mankind, to try to destroy them. That's the story we're told in the Bible. That his motivation for bringing us down is jealousy, rage, and anger over the fact that he not only couldn't have the place that he wanted, but that he lost his place over the issue, and that he is hell-bent to destroy us. We're told that Satan is a thief, a liar, a murderer, that is what is what he is all about. If you look at the whole situation with Satan and death, we realize that death is a curse. It's a part of the punishment for the fall. When Adam gave his authority to Satan, we came under the control of Satan. Satan is the god of this world, and death is his tool. So what happens is, when people died, they went to Sheol. And if you think of Sheol as kind of like Satan's trophy room, he has all of the people who's captured in death there, including Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, whatever. And he had planned to put Jesus in there. That was what his goal was. He got a little shock when Jesus came and could not be contained by death, because death could not rule over him because he was guiltless. And so we see this big battle there. So Satan has got a couple things in mind. One is to destroy mankind, and then because of the mankind is flows out of Christ, but particularly Israel, and then of course the Church of Jesus Christ. And when we get to Revelation, there's a lot of conversation about those things, about the woman and the child and all that sort of thing. So let's see here. In Jude 9, Michael the Archangel. I quoted this to you a little bit earlier. When he disputed with the devil and argued about the body of Moses, did not pronounce over him a railing judgment, but just said, "The Lord rebuke you." All right, so the 10th chapter of Daniel, remember 10, 11, 12, is all about the vision, just that last vision he had. The 10th chapter is designed just to tell us how Daniel gets the message and all the circumstances around that. The 11th chapter is the near-term fulfillment of the vision, and the 12th chapter it points toward the long-term fulfillment of the vision. The 11th chapter of Daniel is one of the probably most understood chapters of Daniel, because we have it's past, it's already happened, it's occurred. It's easier to nail down who the various players are and what they're about. We can go back and look at the historical record and see how the things work themselves out. So the top little paragraph there is at the top of all three of these, where I'm talking about the three different chapters and what they're all about. Chapter 1, the struggle with Satan to get God's answer back to Daniel, important because it reveals the spiritual nature of the geopolitical evil in the world. Remember that Daniel has been given visions that are geopolitical in nature. He's been given visions that where God defines what's going to happen with Israel in terms of the great nations that are a part of what's going on with their life all the way to the end. So we had the Persians, and then we had the Medes, and then we had the Babylonians, and the Persians, the Medes, Greeks, and then the Romans, and then the Romans at the end. It shouldn't surprise us that the demonic forces are geopolitical as well in terms of how Daniel is perceiving it. Number two, the near-term future involving Alexander and his successors and their spiritually driven oppression of the beautiful lands, which is Palestine. A preview of modern-day struggles in the Middle East. That's what chapter 11 is all about. The near-term future fulfillment of Daniel's vision, or the part of Daniel's vision that applies to the near-term. And then the third chapter, which is 12, the eschatological events that precede the second coming and the emergence of the Antichrist. So let me stop for just a minute and see before I launch into 11, because it's pretty detailed, if we're okay, if everybody understands what we're saying here. As far as Daniel's concerned, and frankly, as far as God's concerned, the vast majority of all end-time prophecy relates to Israel. By the time we get down to the brass tacks at the time of the tribulation, it'll be about Israel. The rest of us will be side players, and we'll have roles and bits and pieces, and eventually we'll be taken out altogether. So it's about Israel, and that's how Daniel is seeing all of this.
Please. Clarification on point one. What's the struggle with Satan to get God to answer back to Daniel? Who's struggling with?
You weren't here when I got started. But what we read at the first part of Daniel 10 is that Daniel prayed and got no answer from God for 21 days. But at the end of 21 days, this messenger angel came and said to Daniel, "From the first moment you prayed and fasted and humbled yourself, I was sent with a message. But the prince of Persia, who is the demonic presence that Satan has installed over Persia, resisted me to give you the answer." And so Michael had to come and push him out of the way. Okay, that's what that means. What we know about the spiritual realm is often understood in, as we read the scriptures, it's sort of understood from the side. You know, we don't get a book on angels, but we see how they operate and what all goes on by reading the stories about what all they do. The Jews had a very developed angelology. The Jewish angelology is much more developed than the Christian angelology, and they took their understanding of it from the Old Testament writings and from their Midrash and some other things that they studied. Most of it is perfectly acceptable, but theirs was quite developed. Alright, Daniel 11:1. "In the first year of Darius the Mede, which would be 536 BC, I arose to be an encouragement and a protection for him. But now I tell you the truth. Behold, three more kings are going to arise in Persia. Then a fourth will gain far more riches than all of them, and as soon as he becomes strong through his riches, he will arouse the whole empire against the realm of Greece." So Daniel says that in the first king of Darius the Mede, Darius the Mede is usually also thought of as Cyrus the Persian. Remember, the Medes and the Persians were relatives, and these people were kings of both nations, and they had double names, etc. So So most scholars believe that Cyrus the Persian was also Darius the Mede. He would have been identified uniquely in both subcultures. Peter, for instance, the Apostle Peter, was known as Simon to the Jews, Petros to the Greek-speaking Gentiles. Carlos Estevez, brother of Emilio, is also known as Charlie Sheen. We call him Charlie. We actually call him Goofball now. We call him Charlie, but his mother calls him Carlos still. A succession of four kings is now foretold. There's going to be four kings, with the fourth one coming and having a little bit more play in the deal. Four kings that he refers to are Cambyses, Pseudo-Smerdis, Darius Astyages, or Darius the Great, and then Xerxes, the Greek name Ahasuerus, in 486 to 465. Xerxes was also called, see if I can pronounce that, Kayarsh or something by the Persians. Now, Xerxes, the person he's talking about there, is the one who is the king of Persia at the time of Esther, when we get the whole story of Esther. A major thorn to the Greek city-states he was, and he ignites the passions of Greece to conquer Persia and its vassal states. His defeat at Salamis caused him to take comfort in his harem. The failure of Vashti, his queen, to honor him, got her to depose his queen, and he is the king of the book of Esther, Esther's name is a replacement for Queen Vashti. But what you have is that these Persian kings, Cambyses and Phalsmerdis, who did not last long, and then Darius the first, these people ruled over Persia when Persia was a very strong empire. But during the time of their rule, there is an emergence in Macedonia of a king named Philip. And Philip has rallied the Greek states to come together. And Philip has many sons, but he has one particularly very young, bright son who at 18 becomes a general in his army. His name is Alexander. And as the Greek city-states get larger and larger and more connected and more threatening, the Persians begin to see them as more and more of a threat. And so it becomes a mounting concern. What happens to Xerxes is that he decides to go out and make war against Alexander, and he gets his head handed to him at Salamis. If you've ever read the whole story, it was a scenario where we outgunned him, he had more ships and the whole nine yards, but he was foolish about the way he used them, and so he gets defeated. He comes home in licking his wounds, and it takes Alexander some time to mount his winds into a big, real strong power, but Persia's been gutted at this particular point in time. What's left of Persia's empire is now very weak and fragile, and Alexander is free to move and grow his empire. So he comes home, and like I said, he was pouting and not having a good time. So he decides to enjoy his harem and throw some big parties and stuff like that. And it was during this particular time, right about this time, that this whole thing happens with Queen Esther.
So when Darius the First, right before Xerxes, that's the one we're talking about up here right now.
No, it's a different one.
Different one.
Yeah. Yeah, Darius the Mede and Cyrus the Persian, Cyrus the Great, and Darius the Mede are precede Cambyses. This Darius is called Histopses, which is another guy altogether. The dates for these people are in history. You can find.
Was this Darius the Mede the one that threw him in the lion's den?
Darius the Mede is the one who was constrained to throw him in the lion's den, but didn't want to. Remember, Darius the Mede prayed all night that Daniel would be saved.
Oh, that is the one.
Yeah. So remember, Nebuchadnezzar has the kingdom and Babylon. He has the kingdom when Daniel's brought in as a young boy. And what happens is that he and his young fellows are faithful to the Lord. Daniel comes in and interprets Nebuchadnezzar's dream about the four great kingdoms. Remember, Nebuchadnezzar has a dream and he won't even tell him what the dream is. So Daniel comes in and he rises in the empire. The three kids, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they develop a lot of political enemies because they're Daniel's henchmen. And at one particular point in time, some people bring charges against them that causes them to get thrown into the fiery furnace, but God rescues them and whatever. Meanwhile, what we have is Nebuchadnezzar having this experience of another dream, and God is telling him he's going to humble him. So we got about the fourth chapter of Daniel is all about the humbling of Nebuchadnezzar and his living in the field and eating grass like an ox for a long period of time. And Daniel saves his kingdom for him. He gets restored. And he gives testimony to the God of heaven and earth as being the God. He acknowledges who God is. That's Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar dies, his son Nabonidus takes over, and Nabonidus' grandson Belshazzar takes over. Nabonidus is out doing all this warfare with Persia, between Persia and Babylon. Belshazzar is home being the playboy prince, and finally, at the end of the day, he's having a big party. They decide they're going to play with the vessels from the temple. They bring them in to have a big party with the vessels of the temple. And God doesn't like it, so he sends the hand in, writes on the wall, you know, your date, you're done, you're over. Okay? That very night, what happened is that Darius the Mede, or Cyrus the Persian, gets his army outside, having wiped out Nabonidus, which is news has not gotten there yet. But he brings his army to the doors to the gates of Babylon, and the city fathers throw it open because they know he'll tear the place down. They love their city more than they love their king. They couldn't care less who rules. So they throw it open and goes in, and per Daniel's prophecy, Belshazzar meets his maker that night. And so the Medes then take over Babylon, the city, and the kingdom and the empire. And so that starts off with Darius the Mede, Cyrus the Persian. And then what you have after him is Cambyses. And then false Smyrnus is a guy who actually got there by assassination. Wasn't there very long. And then you have Darius Darius the First. So he has Aristopheses. So then we get to the time of Xerxes, who is the Persian king when the Persian Empire, the Media Persian Empire, is in its descendancy, and he makes way for Greece. So what Daniel is seeing here is the fall of the House of Persia and the emergence of Greece. That's what he's seen so far in this vision. Oh, good. I want to give you a chance to get back. Okay. All right. In verse 3, a mighty king will arise, and he will rule with great authority and do as he pleases. But as soon as he has arisen, his kingdom will be broken up and parceled out toward the four points of the compass, though not to his own descendants, nor according to his authority which he wielded, for his sovereignty will be uprooted and given to others beside him. So what happens is that after Artaxerxes finally falls, Alexander emerges. Alexander conquers the world by the time he's 30 or 33 or some such number. And he is now brokenhearted because there's no more worlds to conquer. And so he sets out to have a party that lasts, a drunken revelry that lasts a good year. And in the process, he winds up getting himself killed in the middle of it. When he does, his four generals slaughter his children and divide the kingdom up among themselves. And those generals are Seleucus, Ptolemy, Lysimachus, and Cassander. These are historical realities, okay? So when they do this, they divide the kingdom up into four points of the compass. And it's not Alexander's children. It is these people who took this. So 150 years later, Alexander the Great and his Greeks conquered the Persians. The campaign took only 13 short years, from 336 to 323. He is only 33 years old when he died, leaving behind two small children who quickly met with accidents. His empire is divided among his four generals. And the division of the empire into these four pieces is important because much of the history of Israel plays out through this. For instance, the north and the south. Whenever Israel, the prophets are talking about the north and the south, and they're talking about Israel, they mean from the standpoint of Palestine. And so what we find is the king of the north is Seleucus, which is Syria, Babylon, Iraq, and Palestine. That's who got that area. The king of the south is Ptolemy, which is Egypt. In the east is Lysimachus, which is Thrace and Bithynia, sometimes also called Asia Minor or a big part of Asia Minor. And the west is Cassander, which is Macedonia, Greece, and Western Europe, or Rome. This is where Rome comes from. Eventually we'll see the emergence of Rome out of that particular piece. But for some time to come now, Israel is going to be caught between the king of the north and the king of the south. The king of the north being the Seleucid kings and the king of the south being the Ptolemies. So let me go forward. Then the king of the south will grow strong. There is a constant yin and yang between these two kingdoms. And it's an ebb and flow of power. And at times the Seleucids are in power, are in ascendancy, and there are times when the Egyptians are in ascendancy. And right in the middle is Palestine, and they keep getting just trampled over back and forth, back and forth. All of this goes on between this time frame until about 165 BC, when the Maccabees rise up and throw the Syrians, the Seleucids, out and wind up ruling for 100 years in Israel, under the house of Hyrcanus, until Pompey comes along in 65, 66, 7, and captures Israel again, and Julius Caesar then rules and reigns, and they're under Rome's authority after that point on. So then the king of the south will go strong, along with one of his princes, who will gain ascendancy over him and obtain dominion. His dominion will be a great dominion indeed. After some years, it will form an alliance. And the daughter of the king of the south will come to the king of the north to carry out a peaceful arrangement. Now what happens is Ptolemy the First emerges as a strong force with the help of Seleucus and gains control of a vast empire around 312 BC. Berenice, who is the daughter of Ptolemy the Second, marries Antiochus the Second, the grandson of Seleucus the First. Now all the Seleucid kings either go by the name of Seleucus or Antiochus. And most of the Egyptian kings go either by the name of Ptolemy or Alexander, something to do with Alexander, usually. So Berenice, the daughter of Ptolemy II, marries Antiochus II, the grandson of Seleucus I. So remember that it's not at all uncommon, even up in the times of modern times, for people to consolidate empires through marriage. You know, at the time that we get into the parents of Queen Elizabeth, the family that's running all of Europe is the same family. It's a bunch of Germans. And they're just living in different countries. If you've ever read any of the stories or seen any of the movies about Queen Victoria and Prince Albert, you can see this really well. Because Victoria was from a German family. She was a young girl from a German family. And Prince Albert was from a German family. And the emperor of Germany claimed ascendancy over all the family. And he had a guy who worked for him who was a baron who was kind of a brilliant mastermind guy. And he would go back and forth and kind of run things. And so the whole process of bringing Prince Albert from Europe, from Germany, to marry Victoria was designed to get better control by Germany over England. But what happened was Albert fooled him. He loved his wife more than he loved his lineage, and he helped set her up firmly on her throne and basically ended the heavy-duty influence of the Germans. Now, even though later, as the family goes on, they still have these German ties. And you will remember that Prince David, who became Edward II, who abdicated the throne because he wanted to marry Wallace Simpson, who was the American divorcee, was a huge admirer and a friend of Adolf Hitler's. And one of the great problems that the British had before he was abdicated, but especially afterwards, is that he had a railway pass. He could go all over Europe, but to the Nazi realm, anywhere he wanted to. And he was very likely to show up at some Hitler party somewhere with all the news cameras flashing, toasting him about how great he was. And so they had to do something with it, and so they made him the titular ruler of Bermuda, which is about as far away as they could get him, and that's where he wound up going in exile, was Bermuda. But he was a big-time Nazi and felt like that they should just cooperate with Hitler and everybody, and the whole thing would run right. So we are sort of fortunate that he got all excited about his American mistress. Otherwise, the whole process of the Second World War would have been altogether different.
Wasn't Frederick of Germany in World War I the grandson of Queen Victoria? Ever seen that?
I don't know. Could be.
I think it is. And isn't it? It's kind of quite interesting that here you have, you know, a power with, you know, Queen Victoria, and then you've got a grandson, and they're going to war and kill one of these people. It gets very interesting.
It's very likely because they intermarried.
And it became so unpopular, their German name became so unpopular after World War I, just by decree, one day they said, we're Windsors.
Yeah, they changed from Saxe-Coburn.
Yeah.
They changed from Saxe-Coburn to Windsor. And the chances are that that's exactly right. I just don't know that for sure. But they all intermarried, you know, constantly.
Well, I just think that's interesting. I mean, I didn't know that up until like the last couple of years. And the more you find out about who's in power in these European states and how it has to be pure evil, because literally they're related, and yet they're allowing the states that they're supposedly being ruler over just to, you know, to kill themselves. I mean, or kill each other.
Well, the thing is, though, is,
I mean, you have to look at, there's another power.
But it's not new.
Yeah.
It's not new, because you have the Romans marrying all, you know, Cleopatra is marrying Julius and Mark Antony. I mean, you have people intermarrying for power play purposes all down through history. You got Solomon marrying the Queen of Sheba, who is the queen of the Cushites, which is one of the Egyptian states. And you have, Solomon's basically destroyed by all of his political alliances and marriages. So that's been going on. And that's what happens here. What happens here is that the daughter of one of the Ptolemies marries a grandson of one of the Seleucids in order to try to consolidate the two kingdoms so that they won't be fighting each other. So it says here, the king of the south will grow strong, along with one of his princes who will gain ascendancy over him, obtain dominion, his domain, the sea. I think I read that. Yeah, Berenice, daughter of Ptolemy, marries Antiochus II. the grandson of Seleucus I. In doing so, she displaces Antiochus's first wife, Laodice, and her son, which is going to come back to haunt her. But she will not retain her position or power, Daniel goes on to say, nor will he remain with his power, but she will be given up along with those who brought her in and the one who sired her, as well as he who supported her in those times. But one of the descendants of her line will rise in his place, and he will come against their army and enter the fortress of the king of the north. And he will deal with them and display great strength, and also their gods and their metal images and their precious vessels of silver and gold. He will take into captivity to Egypt. He, on his part, will refrain from attacking the king of the north for some years. Then the latter will enter the realm of the king of the south, but will return to his own land. Upon the death of Ptolemy II, Berenice was deposed and murdered along with her supporters by Laodice and her son, Seleucus II, the first displaced wife. Berenice's brother, Ptolemy III, avenges her death and defeats the Seleucids. He executes those who murdered Berenice, and he conquers the Syrian capital. He loots Damascus and Antioch of many treasures and sends them back to Egypt. He then agrees to a 10-year truce with Seleucus II and goes home to Egypt. It's a mistake. Once he's avenged his sister and taken a lot of tribute out, he decides to cut a deal with this guy and then go home, and it comes back to bite him. And then Daniel 10, remember, Daniel is prophesying this many hundreds of years before it's happening. His sons will mobilize and assemble a multitude of great forces. One of them will keep on coming and overflow and pass through. They may again wage war up to his very fortress. The king of the south will be enraged and go forth and fight with the king of the north. Then the latter will raise a great multitude, but that multitude will be given in the hand of the former. When the multitude is carried away, his heart will be lifted up, and he will cause tens of thousands to fall, yet he will not prevail. For the king of the north will again raise a greater multitude than the former, and after an interval of some years, he will press on with a great army and much equipment. Lots of detail, very rich in detail. The son of Seleucus II, that is Seleucus III and Antiochus III, his two sons, raise armies against Egypt. Ptolemy IV, a peaceable man and a good general, defeats them handily. He kills over 15,000 Syrian troops, which is verse 11 and 12. In 217 BC, he fails to consolidate his hold on Palestine because worldwide domination was not his goal. Verse 14. Now, in those times, many will rise against the king of the south. The violent ones among your people will also lift themselves up in order to fulfill the vision, but they will fall down. Then the king of the north will come and cast a siege mount and capture a well-fortified city, and the forces of the south will not stand their ground, not even their choicest troops, for there will be no strength to make a stand. But he who comes against him will do as he pleases, and no one will be able to withstand him. He also will stay for a time in the beautiful land, which is Palestine, and with destruction in his hands. So the fulfillment of this, the Jewish insurgents, the people of your people, Jewish insurgents futilely attempt to drive Ptolemy out of Israel. When Ptolemy IV dies, Antiochus III raises yet another Syrian army. He drives the Egyptians out of Palestine in 201 BC. He enters Jerusalem to delight the Jews in 198. He reaffirms the Jewish religion and practice suppressed by Egypt. And he dwells there for a season as a defense against the Egyptian resurgency in fulfillment of Daniel's prophecy. Verse 17. And he will set his face to come with the power of the whole kingdom, bringing with him a proposal of peace, which he will put into effect. But he will also give him the daughter of women to ruin it. But she will not take a stand for him or be on his side. Then he will turn his face to the coastlands and capture many. But a commander will put a stop to his scorn against him. Moreover, he will repay him for his scorn. So he will turn his face toward the fortress of his own land, and he will stumble and fall and be found no more. Antiochus III offers a truce and his daughter in marriage to Ptolemy V. Her name was Cleopatra I, not to be confused with the one that Elizabeth Taylor, who died today, by the way, Elizabeth Taylor played. She sides with her husband against her father, undermining the truce. So she was meant to go in and secure a political alliance, but instead she sides, just like we're talking about Albert and Victoria, she sides with her husband and undermines the truce. Antiochus then moves to capture and fortify Asia Minor, which is Anatolia or Galatia on the Mediterranean Sea. That's the coastlands we're talking about. He was soundly defeated by the Roman general Scipio in 190 BC. This was the beginning of the Roman hegemony in the region. Now, they're not powerful, totally powerful, until later, but this is the beginning. Antiochus died in 187, looting a temple in Susa in order to raise the tribute money that he owes to Ptolemy because of all this is going on. Now, we're going to come to somebody who's much more important to us. Then in his place will arise one who will send an oppressor throughout the jewel of his kingdom, yet within a few days he will be shattered, though neither in anger nor in battle. And in his place, a despicable person will arise on whom the honor of kingship has not been conferred. But he will come in a time of tranquility and seize the kingdom by intrigue. And the overflowing forces will be flooded away before him and shattered, and also the prince of the covenant. This particular person is going to be the person who Jesus models the Antichrist after. Antiochus III's son, Seleucus IV, then tries to raise money through taxation, but he is soon assassinated. Seleucus IV's brother executes the assassin and murders Seleucus' minor son through intrigue. Assuming the throne is Antiochus IV. So instead of his son taking the throne, his brother kills the son and takes the throne in his place. And he becomes known as Antiochus IV. He was also called Antiochus Epiphanes because he disappeared out of nowhere. The word Epiphanes suggests that he disappeared. Whose deeds Jesus referring to in Matthew 24:15 when he talks about the one who makes desolate and all that. All right, 11:30. Verse B. And Antiochus will return and become enraged at the Holy Covenant, and he take action. So he will come back and show regard for those who forsake the Holy Covenant, and forces from him will arise, desecrate the sanctuary, a fortress, and do away with the regular sacrifice. Remember we talked before about how Antiochus and Epiphanes put a statue of... Did I skip a page? Okay. All right, I did. I skipped a page. No. All right, that's okay. We'll get to him in a minute. It's the whole same thing, okay? Let's see. Yeah, well, that would be the right thing, wouldn't it? All right. After an alliance is made with him, he will practice deception, and he will go up and gain power with a small force of people. In a time of tranquility, he will enter the richest parts of the realm. He will accomplish what his fathers never did, nor his ancestors. He will distribute plunder, booty, and possessions among them, and he will devise his schemes against the strongholds for only for a time. So the despicable man has no honor, and the schemes incessantly against everyone. He is the type for the Antichrist. He will stir up his strength and courage against the king of the south with a large army, as the king of the south will mobilize an extremely large and mighty army for war. But he will not stand. So even though Ptolemy's raised up a huge army, they get defeated. For schemes will be devised against them. One of the things we see about Antiochus Epiphany is he's very deceptive and very scheming, and that's once again part of the... how Jesus describes and others describes the Antichrist. Those who eat his choice food will destroy him, and his army will overflow, but many will fall down slain. As for both kings, their hearts will be intent on evil. They will speak lies to each other at the same table, but will not succeed, for the end is still to come at the appointed time. Then he will return to his land with much plunder, but his heart will be set against the Holy Covenant, which means Israel, and he will take action and return to his own land. So when Cleopatra I dies in 176 BC, Antiochus IV marches against Egypt. She was the power. Through intrigue, he conquers a superior Egyptian force in 170-169 BC. He becomes the protector of her son, Ptolemy IV. He basically takes over and says, I'm going to be your son's protector, which means he's going to control him. Giving him, Antiochus IV, control over Egypt. The Egyptians, however, made Ptolemy IV's youngest brother an opposition king in fortified Alexandria. Antiochus makes a futile attempt to defeat him in Alexandria, but he failed in the attempt and he retreated to Jerusalem. He despoiled the temple of much treasure and went home. When you go out to battle and you've got to have a bunch of tribute and you lose, you've got to find your tribute somewhere. So he falls back on Jerusalem and takes everything of value there so that he can go home successful. The two Egyptian princes become reconciled and they co-reign in Egypt, both Ptolemy the IV and his brother. At the appointed time, he will return into the south, but this last time it will not turn out the way it did before. For the ships of Kittim will come against him, and therefore he will be disheartened. So, rearming himself, this is Antiochus, he makes another attempt to conquer Alexandria. But the Romans on ships from Cyprus, which is the modern name for Kittim, arrive and tell him to back off. Antiochus capitulates without a fight and falls back upon Jerusalem. Remember, he's already got his clock cleaned by the Romans once, and he doesn't want to do it again. Falls back on Jerusalem. Roman dominance of the Mediterranean grows from this point in time. And Antiochus will return and become enraged at the Holy Covenant and take action. So now, falling back on Jerusalem, he's decided to really take it out on the Jews this time because he's been so embarrassed and defeated. And because, the truth is they actually celebrate. They hear he died. And they mounted a large celebration. Of course, it turned out to be not true. And once he found out about it, he wasn't happy. He will come back and show regard for those who forsake the Holy Covenant. And forces from him will arise, desecrate the sanctuary fortress, and do away with the regular sacrifice. Remember, we talked about this before, that when the Antichrist, or when Antiochus Epiphanes finally does all of this, that he ends the temple sacrifice by setting up a statue of Zeus and slaughtering hogs in it. And he ends it for 1150 days, which is 2300 morning and evening services. So forces from him will arise, desecrate the sanctuary forces, and do away with the regular sacrifice. They will set up the abomination of desolation, which we've talked about before. The abomination which desolates the temple. By smooth words, he will turn to godlessness those who act wickedly toward the covenant, but the people who knew their God will display strength and take action. One of the things that's happening during all this time frame with from 330 until the present time is there are many Jews who are trying to syncretize or blend themselves with the Hellenists. The people, because they get tired of being the constant pawns in between, and they find that they're better off just to be Hellenistic and not Jewish. Antiochus does things like tries to set all the synagogues up as gymnasia, tries to reorient the synagogue worship into Greek gymnasia behavior. He tries to set up the 7-day week as a 10-day week, which was something the Greeks tried on a number of occasions because they're far more into tens than they are into sevens. And he does all of these things. And there were many Jews who capitulated and joined with him. And these people were his supporters. There were, however, those zealots, there always are, those zealots who hung in with God and stood up against all of this. And so there was a lot of internal conflict in Israel when all of this was going on. So then he says, the people who knew their God will display strength and take action. Now news of his reversal emboldens the Judeans, who lay siege to Antiochus' hand-picked high priest. Antiochus, enraged, comes from Jerusalem and puts down the resistance. He supports the Hellenized liberal Jews who have forsaken the covenant. He desecrates the temple by putting a statue of Zeus in the Holy of Holies on December the 25th, 167 B.C., he sacrifices pigs on the altar. He also dedicates the temple to Baal. The morning and evening sacrifices are stopped for 1150 days, which we were prophesied in 814. But the followers of Yahweh rise up in defiance, especially the Maccabees. I'll talk about them in just a minute. Those who have insight among the people will give understanding to the many. Yet they will fall by the sword and by flame, by captivity, by plunder for many days. Now when they fall, they will be granted a little help and many will join them in hypocrisy. And some of those who have insight will fall in order to refine, purge, and make them pure until the end time, because it is still to come at the appointed time. So Mattathias, an Orthodox priest from a town near Jerusalem, kills a Syrian officer who was coming to enforce the pagan sacrifice at the temple. He and his five sons, led by Judas the Hammer Hand, whose the name would be in Aramaic would be Maccabeus, Judas the Hammer Hand, then led an insurgent force against the Syrians and their Jewish collaborators for 3 years. Against overwhelming odds, the cost of many lives, they prevail. On December the 25th, 1164 BC, they cleanse and rededicate the temple. These hard and difficult times purged Israel's religious practice and led to a rise of Pharisaism, which is the strict observance of the law of Moses. This is why Pharisaism emerges, because the blending of Judaism along with the Hellenistic religions and thinking, the syncretism that's there, is so abominable to the Jews that they hyper-react back and say, a very strict adherence to the law of Moses is where we're going. From this point on, Phariseeism begins to define Orthodox Judaism in very, very surprising ways. The Pharisees were about 5% of the population, but they had an inordinate influence on the practice of Judaism. So for all practical purposes, Israel enjoyed independence then for the next 100 years until Rome conquered them in 163 BC under Pompey. Now the Feast of Hanukkah is derived from this period. An oil lamp must burn at all time in the Holy of Holies. The oil lamp must be ritually pure. The oil must be ritually pure. In the book of Exodus, there is a huge formula, very detailed formula, that God gives for making this oil, exactly how it's to be done. And so it has to be right. It has to be ritually pure and dedicated for this purpose. Only one qualified vial of oil was found for the rededication. Miraculously, it is believed, the single one-day vial burned for 8 days until some more could be produced. It took 8 days to produce this according to the ritual. Hence, Hanukkah, meaning dedication, was celebrated from 25 Kislev to 2nd Adar, that's December 25th to January 2nd, from that point on. Hanukkah occurs near the same time as the Christian celebration of Christmas and is also known as the Feast of Lights. The Feast of Dedication is mentioned in the also in the New Testament, which is another name for Hanukkah. All right, that's Daniel 11.
So when you said the Pharisees were only about 5% of the population,
the time of Christ, the Pharisees represented, we're told by Josephus, about 5% of the population, but their influence over the practice of Judaism was much, much stronger than that. The Jews were people who weren't Pharisees still obeyed what the Pharisees said was law. Yeah, remember when Jesus came to minister among the people, he went down among the people and was rejected pretty much by the Pharisees, except for a few like Nicodemus and Joseph of Arimathea, some of those folks. But the common people very often were casual synagogue goers. They didn't particularly have a strong religious practice. Many of them were—they had a good relationship with God, but they didn't have religious practice. So the Pharisees made fun of them, picked at them, called them unclean because they wouldn't keep the Sabbath the way that they wanted them to. There was all these particular issues. So when Jesus came, he went to those people. The common, everyday, ordinary people, like, for instance, the fishermen, Simon, Andrew, James, and John, they were not Pharisees. They would not live clean enough to be Pharisees. And yet, the implications of the law, you know, you couldn't heal on the Sabbath and all that kind of stuff. People were afraid of the Pharisees. They were afraid to go against them. You see a story, for instance, in blind Bartimaeus, where he is healed. He's been blind from birth. He's healed. And he begins to give testimony to Jesus as being the miracle worker who healed him. He says he must be the Son of God, because where has it ever been heard that someone who was born blind could be made whole? Well, the Pharisees had put out a mandate, almost like a fatwa in today's environment, but they had put out a law, as the Sanhedrin had put out a law, saying that anyone who supported Jesus could be dismissed from the synagogue. If you were shunned out of the synagogue, you couldn't do business with other Jews. No Jews could do business with you. You couldn't sleep with your wife unless she was willing to be put out of Sanhedrin. You couldn't visit your children. And so the whole process of being disenfranchised from the synagogue was quite a threat. And the Sanhedrin and the Pharisaic leaders had issued, the Sanhedrin had an official decree, but they were out trying to basically nail anybody who was supporting Jesus. Well, blind Bartimaeus couldn't give a flip. There were a whole lot of people in Israel who didn't give a flip what the Pharisees thought. They were basically walking according to what they thought was right, but of course they were unclean, and many of those people were shunned or disenfranchised from the synagogue. Blind Bartimaeus couldn't care less. He could see. And before this, he couldn't see for all the days of his life. And so he gave glory to God and to Christ for having healed him. Well, they challenged him on the basis that that Christ must be, that he's got an unholy background. His mother was probably a tramp and all the kinds of things that they were saying about Jesus at that time. And Bartimaeus said, this is an amazing thing that a person who you say is this evil was able to heal a man born blind. And he would say, they would say, well, can you tell us where he is or whatever? He said, I don't know where he is. And he'd say, do you want to follow him too? And they were telling him he was born in sin and all this kind of stuff. You remember the story. Well, in order to guarantee that this was indeed a man born blind and not some sort of scam, they called his parents in for the purposes of testifying that this was their son, a man born blind, that Jesus had healed him. Well, they didn't want to get involved with this at all. Their whole point was, is we got to do business in this town. We can't do this. So what they said was, is we know this is our son, and we know he's born blind. The rest, we don't know. You'll have to ask him. He's of age. So they weren't coming down on this for nothing. This was politically way too expensive, economically way too expensive. And so they were hedging all over the place, like a fish on the deck. So, but not blind Bartimaeus. He got healed. That's what he knew. But that's the fear of the Pharisees that was upon them. That's why when Jesus would sometimes go face to face with the Pharisees, he would tell them, you travel land and sea to make a single convert, and then you wind up making them seven times child. Hell, you are. He was quite vocal about it. And he picked them apart quite a bit. And their decrees against him, he couldn't care less about.
Matthew 23, I think, is a chapter. I think it's the whole chapter, right? All of Matthew 23.
What is it you're speaking of?
Oh, that's Christ is talking to the Pharisees, and it's just, he's hammering them one after another,
Yeah.
What they're doing and how they're getting in the way of.
Yeah, well, it's late in the game. Matthew 24 is where he starts talking about end times. And the collapse of the temple.
He does nothing but really goes after the Sanhedrin.
Well, what happens is that they're bringing it to a head.
Yeah.
Because they're basically chasing him down to kill him, to try to discredit him and all those other things as well. So, all right, other comments? I don't want to get into 12 tonight, because we've covered a lot. I will tell you, though, that 12 will finish Daniel. Once we get done with 12, we're done with Daniel, and we have to decide what we want to do next, if you all want to go forward with the class. But concerning that, well, we can talk about that next week. But what, anything on 11 that you'd like to talk about?
Sure seems like a lot of the earthly men were being, positioned in different ways. To bring everything.
Well, the prophecy didn't cause them to do this. Foreknowledge is not the same as cause. You know what I'm saying? So when you're talking about the Antiochuses and the Seleucids and the Ptolemies and all those people, the prophecies of Daniel didn't make them do that. He is just foretelling in advance that this is what they will do. They have free will.
And that's exactly what happened, though, isn't it?
Yeah, what happened, he is telling, the thing about prophecy is not, it doesn't have any causative effect. You know, sometimes we get a little confused with that because we say, well, Judas didn't have any choice but to betray Jesus because it was prophesied. Well, the implication in there somehow or another is that because it was prophesied, Judas was compelled. But that's not the way it was. Prophecy is just a matter of going forward into the future and seeing what happens and telling about it before it happens. It has no causal effect whatsoever. But it's an important distinction because people do make that decision. I mean, they make that kind of a jump that, well, how can you blame Judas? It was prophesied he was going to do this, How can you blame the Jews for killing him? It was prophesied this was going to happen. The prophets don't cause anything. They just foretell what will happen. God doesn't cause anything by prophesying. You may be able to project quite clearly that that car, which is sliding, is going to go off that cliff. Because it's moving along quite a clip and there's nothing in between it. And it's heading, you may be able to prophesy that car is going off of that cliff. That doesn't mean you caused it just because you foreknew it. You see what I'm saying?
Yes.
So he had no causal effect on it. Now Daniel is, his whole point is that Daniel is a lover of Israel. From the very beginning of his life as a young man forward, he is trying to be faithful to the God of Israel and to the people of Israel. And God has projected him into a place of leadership and power and whatever, and he's often being used to protect Israel or to be, you know, to do things for Israel in the midst of captivity. And when he sees that the time of Jeremiah is at hand, that there should be a restoration of Jerusalem coming, and he's not getting what he wants. He's hearing from the people who have gone back with Zerubbabel that everything's bogged down, that they're not getting the wall built, they're not getting the temple built, and he's frustrated. And so he goes and prays before the Lord and says, "What is it we're supposed to understand here?" And he has a series of three visions, all of which have to do with these four nations. And then this last one having to do with the same thing, you know, because you're going to get to the Roman impact of this in the 12th chapter. But so he has these visions. Now, one of the things that's pretty interesting about Daniel is that the vision in chapter 11 is passed to us. It was forward to Daniel, but it's passed to us. So we're in a much better position to determine whether or not it was accurate. When we look and see the level of accuracy, the specificity with which he covers all this stuff, even if you're wrong about a couple of players, the overall accuracy of it is pretty high. It's like when Isaiah prophesies that Cyrus is going to deliver the Jews and send them, you know, back, and he prophesies that 150 years before Cyrus was born. The liberal scholars say, well, then Isaiah must have been written much later, after, because no one can do that. Their basic argument is you can't do that because you can't do that. And no one can do that because they do not accept the idea that there might actually be a God who knows what's going on. So you have mounted in scholarly work a whole bunch of people who are trying to predict, who are trying to say that these things are all written much later than they're purported to be written. And they're not written by Isaiah, they're written by other people who claim to be Isaiah. In other words, that they're out and out frauds. That these documents are fraudulent. If they are fraudulent, Jesus thought they were true. Paul thought they were true. You know, John thought they were true. James thought they were true. So if they fool Jesus, John, and James, I ain't going to sweat it a whole lot, you know. In the case of Daniel, people have made attempts to try to say that some of this stuff was written afterwards. The problem with Daniel is we're now in recorded history. Now we've got kings in place that are actually identifiable in recorded history, whereas in 800 B.C. we don't have near as much of that going on as we do now. So,
did he share these visions?
Who? Daniel?
Did he share, yeah.
I would think that Daniel shared it in his home group, among his group of friends. Mm-hmm. You have to remember that Daniel left behind writings that caused the Magi to go look for Jesus. Mm-hmm. So Daniel's work typically what would happen is somebody like Daniel would have a lot of young bucks around him who were his disciples, and they would gather his writings and they would write down his, you know, his stuff. I mean, that's how it was. The school of Elijah, I mean, the school of Isaiah, the school of Daniel, whatever. That's how that would happen. So all of that would have been protected and saved. It's an interesting thing in history. I just finished Exodus. I just got done writing Exodus and sending it over to get it formatted. I sent it over to Sam to format it. And one of the interesting things about Exodus is that the Egyptians who ruled Egypt during the time of Joseph were Hyksos. They weren't the traditional Egyptian people. Now, the Hyksos were Semitic tribes that came out of the desert, according to history. It came out of desert during this particular time frame. And basically it took over Egypt, took the ruling class away, and took over Egypt. So when you have the Pharaoh who's receiving Joseph and who is allowing Jacob to come in, he's a Semitic man who is happy to have these other Semitic people come in. And he's actually going to be far more committed to the Semites coming in than he is the regular Egyptians, because the regular Egyptians are being resentful and bitter for the fact that their nation's been taken over. You know, it'd be like somebody comes across our border and basically takes over the government, and all of a sudden we're all speaking Spanish and whatever, and everybody who used to run the place isn't in charge anymore. That's exactly what it was like. Well, what happened is that sometime after this time, the natural Egyptians rose up and threw the Hyksos out. And so you get this whole group of a family of pharaohs that come through, most of whom are named either Ramses or Seti, that are the pharaohs in the time of Moses. So what happens is with the pharaohs in the time of Moses are different than the pharaohs politically at the time of Joseph. Now, what they do when this happens, and it happens all the time, because we just read about how the Babylonians were replaced by the Persians by and Medes and by the whatever. Well, when people have a particularly bitter time with that, they go around and they erase all of the steel and all the records. They burn all the records of the people before them. You know, they get the next set of slaves comes out and they're scraping stone off of these steels to erase all the victories of the Hyksos. So what happens is you have a lot of historical record for Moses and things having to do with Moses and the Jews coming out of and Jews of that day, but very little about the time of Joseph. Not just about Joseph, but very little about even the Hyksos themselves and who those people were. So the victors write history. Yeah, you know, as I say.
So nowadays people, we keep all these records,
That's right. What happens today is that there are counter records. I mean, you couldn't eliminate anymore. And it's been that way for a couple hundred years. There's just been too much records, whatever. There have been attempts made over the last 300-400 years to eradicate certain books and certain philosophies and stuff like that. Sometimes what you're left with is just a handful of representation that were hidden. All right. Anything else before we quit here? And you got to be thinking about what you want to do next. I guess the choices on what we want to do next is we can study the eschaton and then from there go into Revelation, or we can go get a real book of the Bible like Matthew or something or Exodus or something and study it. So why don't you all be thinking about that, and I'll ask you next time what you want to do. Because most people in this class are here for the end times. That's kind of why they're here.
What about Jude? Have you done a study on that?
Yeah, Jude's 10 minutes. It's a one-page book.
Oh. Okay. Well, yeah. Short.
Jude's actually a part of 2 Peter. If you study 1 and 2 Peter, you study Jude. Because it's actually a part of that study. It's like Philemon's a study of Colossians. Okay. Somebody pray us out.